of It's All About Food, and you're listening to PRN, your source for progressive, up-to-date, and inspirational information on nutrition and health.
Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Peter Breggin. Just so glad to be talking again, as I do every week, unless I do a replay, of, everything that's going on in psychiatry, mental health, psychology, sociology. Great guests. We're going to have a very interesting guest on for the second time today. Second time, not today, but the second time in less than a year. And before I go to him, I want to talk a little bit about my past week. Some of you may have bumped into me on television. I went to New York City last week, and I did a 90-minute recording at the 2020 for their show, which aired this past Friday, on the Michelle Carter case. Michelle is the young woman, 17 at the time, accused of texting her boyfriend to commit suicide. And it's a very complicated case, actually. And she was found guilty of manslaughter, which was quite appalling to many, many people. But then the judge came back with a very light sentence. He could have given her 20 years in the penitentiary. The state wanted 7 to 10 at least. But he gave her 15 months, and then he put a stay on it, and it was in a house of corrections in her own county, so it was a whole different story, 15 months in a house of correction. And then he put a stay on it until her case could be appealed, which could take years. So he clearly saw her, as he said, as a juvenile who needs, quote, rehabilitation. Actually, I think she needed her freedom, and she is going to be free, although she has this hanging over her head. So I talked on 2020 about this, and I talked on little talking head comments while I sat for a few hours, actually, in a box, talking head box up at Cornell, to HLN, which is CNN's Henlide News Network. And 48 Hours did a show, used some of the clips from my testimony, a number of other places did stuff on it. Now, 2020, as far as I can tell, is the only one who actually tried to cover the story remotely fairly. And they did give me four, I think they're relatively brief opportunities to sum up the case, that I believed that she was actually a victim of 2 years of bullying by the boy who committed suicide, that she was a victim of bad medical care and a victim of having been put recently on an antidepressant, a change after being taken off Prozac. 3 months earlier, she was put on a new antidepressant, Celexa. So it got a little coverage from my comments, and they also had a very balanced picture. But by and large, everything in the news was hate Michelle Carter. Now, why would everybody want to hate a 17-year-old about whom they know almost nothing? And in fact, what they mostly heard was the cherry-picked worst statement she made during a 10-day breakdown. And I do believe that breakdown was caused by her abusive relationship with this boy who's older than her, kept threatening to kill himself. I mean, multiple times, I'm going to kill myself tonight. There's nothing you can do about it. She felt she loved him and had to save him. This went on for almost 2 years before she broke down for 10 days, during which time she went along with his agreement to help him kill himself, and during which time, I think, under the influence of drugs, she started to talk in a way she never would have. Because Michelle Carter, of all the people in all the cases I've ever worked with and read about, got testimonials about, interviewed family, friends, school teachers, was just about the most positively evaluated, maybe the most positively evaluated person I'd ever had the pleasure to meet. Just a wonderful young woman, and she just got doomed by her desire to help a very disturbed person who was constantly putting her in a very, very difficult situation while they were both on psychiatric drugs. And we can have a lot of empathy for him, too. And there are examples of the empire run wild, the pharmaceutical empire run wild, and of our court system where the district attorneys increasingly persecute as much as they prosecute. They don't come into the court with a sense of justice and balance. They come in to get the person they want to get publicly. And that's what's been going on with Michelle Carter. But it's been really hard work, and it's, you know, but it's satisfying, and I'm glad to be getting the word out about her as much as I can and about the dangers of psych drugs. I'm doing a series on Mad in America. It'll be 5 or 6 long. You can get to them at Mad in America, or you can get to them at Bregan.com, because each one will be have a link on the front page from my frequent alerts. These frequent alerts that now have become really popular. Last one, I think, had 1,500 people checking it out. And Mad in America is really pleased, and so am I, with just how many folks are paying attention to what's going on with my story of Michelle Carter. And they've had over 20,000 now, over 20,000 people review on their website the first installment, and it's moving toward 10,000 on the second installment. These are very large numbers for this kind of blogging and for most websites. And they're pleased and I'm pleased. And I hope that you will, either through my website or going directly on to Mad in America, I hope you will follow the Michelle Carter story. It's a story about an attack on freedom of speech, an attack on a victim of the psychopharmaceutical empire, bad medical practice. She's also a victim of this world in which young people are totally immersed in social media and try to cure each other and save each other in the absence of adult guidance. Very sad to read the thousands of texts I did between Michelle and her friends and Michelle and the boy who killed himself, Conrad Roy. So I'm not going to talk any more about that, but I hope you'll follow my my blog. And I think it's going to have some very interesting new turn of events in the case, because there are new and odd things occurring. So I'll just whet your appetite with that. My guest today, I had the pleasure of spending a fair amount of time with, a little bit of time anyway, more than I usually get at conferences. When I was at the recent conference of reality therapy, I hope some of you were there. I know a number of you came up to me in Raleigh, North Carolina, and said you came because of listening to me on the radio, and we partially sponsored the conference. Which is really very, very good. It's based on the work of William Glass every year, and they have international conferences. I'd be Skyping to the next international in Bogota, Colombia. So it's a very, very great group. And I really think that any of you who are interested in therapy, reading the books of William Glass or like Reality Therapy, and you should just be familiar with the William Glasser Institute. Now, Bob Wubolding, W-U-B-B-O-L-D-I-N-G, he's an EDD, Robert, and he is a practitioner of reality therapy. He's taught choice theory and reality therapy, and choice theory is more and more developed into the basis of reality therapy. He's written, over 100 essays and book chapters, and he's written 10 books, and he's got at least 7 videos out on reality therapy. He's a very interesting man. He's an exciting man. And we're gonna talk today. Bob, are you there? First of all, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dr. Bregan, and thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm really, really looking forward to talking again with you. I want to talk about reality therapy. I want to talk about your new book. And you have many hats, and one of them is board-certified coach. And I've been really talking on this show about this whole idea of developing alternative kinds of therapists, like certified coaches who lie outside, at least at this point, outside of licensure, and people can go to them on the basis of who certified them and whether they think these people are helpful and whether they think the certification group, is a good group. So I just think that we should have much broader representation of helping people out there in the world. I imagine you agree with that, Bob, don't you?
I do. I certainly do. Coaching is an emerging profession, and there's books written on the counselor and the therapist as choosing an alternative to the therapy, and that is the field of coaching. And at the present time, there are no laws in the United States, in any state, that regulate this. They probably will be laws in the future. But coaching fits quite nicely with reality therapy, I must say. And there are some people who really do therapy in the name of coaching, which is really not appropriate. But they call it that. They call it coaching and then do therapy, which I think is something to avoid. But with coaching, you stress the present. You stress dealing with healthy people. Therapy, we sometimes deal with disturbed people. But in coaching, the coach always works and assumes that the person is healthy and helps them establish a career path or a health path, a life path. And reality therapy is quite congruent with that kind of system. So, in fact, it's mentioned in one of the books by Pat Williams, one of the classic books on coaching. It's called The Therapist as a Coach. And he mentions it in there. And in the future, I'm hoping to write a book on that topic. If I do, it'll be my 18th. I have to up that number a little bit. I just published my 17th book on reality therapy. And what I've tried to do, Peter, is to extend the ideas of William Glasser. And I attribute everything to him because, rightfully so, he is the founder and deserves the attribution and the recognition. What I've tried to do is make reality therapy a mainstream counseling and therapy system rather than one that's just kind of mentioned in passing in the textbooks and so on. So that's been a goal that I have. And in so doing, to perpetuate the work of William Glasser, to extend it, to apply it, and to make it applicable and research-based. It isn't. We can say now it is research-supported, but not quite yet research-based. But there is NREP SAMHSA is considering the application that some of us made, the research committee made to them, to endorse it as research-based, which is a pretty big deal these days. So anyway, that's a long answer to your question there.
I think it's such a gray area between therapy and coaching, as I'm sure you'll agree.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, first of all, I try to treat all my clients or patients as if they're normal, and it doesn't matter if they're hallucinating or have really severe impairments of one kind or another. They're normal people who have had just terrible lives. and are trying their best to overcome and handle the enormous stresses that they've been dealing with. So I like to see everybody in a sense as normal. I like to emphasize their strengths, but I also like to look at self-defeating patterns of life, and I like to look at their you know, what's happened to them in their families, that they've developed ways of acting and thinking that aren't good for them. But I'm not sure that coaches, you know, shouldn't be allowed to talk to people about anything they want. I'm just not sure about telling people, helping people, what they can or can't talk about. But goodness knows, certainly the government tries to do that, and it sets down these guidelines for various kinds of health practitioners, you know, about how sick their patients can be. But do you really think those distinctions should be maintained?
Well, I kind of think they're helpful, Peter, because a lot of people who are coaches do not have training in any counseling at all or therapy. And then even more than what I think, there is a profession, International Coach Association, which is, you know, they determine these things and they state these principles. And so, but I have a hunch in the real world where the rubber meets the road, a lot of coaches are dealing with a lot of things. And actually, sometimes the best way to handle a disturbance is to help people make better choices, which are normal. When I teach reality therapy, I teach therapists and counselors, talk to the normal, healthy part of that person. You don't have to know everything about schizophrenia to talk to such a person. Talk to them about their normal decisions and problems and relationships. I was just reading Time magazine yesterday, and there's an article on depression in the August 7th edition. And the last page, it says, drug-free treatments backed by science. And one of them is exercise, one of them is cognitive behavioral therapy, and the one I like mostly is called behavioral activation therapy. In other words, if you're depressed and you're sitting around not doing anything, activate your behavior. What a revelation. You're not doing something, a good thing to do is to do something. And it's like that old joke by W.C. Fields. He said the only cure for insomnia is to get more sleep. And so, you know, the cure for inaction and bad feelings is to do something. Behavioral activation therapy. So, you know, we, of course, start with the idea of empathic listening and trying to connect with that person. But not only in reality therapy, not only connect with where they are, but where they could be. And I always encourage the people I teach and my clients is to, you know, if what you're doing is not working, try something else. That's the theme of the book that I just wrote called Reality Therapy and Self-Evaluation. You know, ask yourself, is this working? Is this helping me? And if it's not, let's try something different. And the point is that activating the action part when a person is feeling bad can be very helpful to them.
That's very consistent with the idea that you have to make choices, well, that in fact you are making choices, even if they're not good ones, and so you might as well make good ones, that even doing nothing and sitting in a paralyzed state is making a choice, if only by some sort of default.
The client doesn't always think of themselves as making choices, and that's one of the empowering interventions we can make is to ask them, well, what did you choose to do today? Or what can you do this afternoon that's different than what you would have done if we'd have not had this conversation? Now, that's not the same as blaming them or criticizing them. As a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. It's respecting them and acknowledging that there is a better life possible to that person who's perhaps victimized by the culture and by society and doesn't see that they have choices. our goal in most, well, in some counseling and therapy is to help them see that, as you often say, is a better life is possible for them. I love your quote, and I always quote this, Peter, from your book, Wow, I'm an American, How to Live Like Our Nation's Heroic Founders. An excellent book I would recommend to anybody. And here's a little statement on page 209. When you learn to consciously choose the direction of your life based on sound principles, you will be surprised to learn how many opportunities are available. That sentence, I hope you write a book about just that sentence. It says, when you learn, which means it's a process, and consciously be aware of the choices and choose the direction of your life based on sound principles, not on taking drugs or yielding to the TV ads that bombard us. But you will be surprised to learn how many opportunities. I mean, it's a very, very powerful statement, I think. So I quote, I
well,
mean, I
thank
you for that.
And thanks for mentioning, Wow, I'm an American. When I was at the conference a few weeks ago that Bob was also there at and presenting at, I had a luncheon talk, and I talked about how William Glasser's choice theory and reality therapy is uniquely American, that it draws on American optimism, American ideas of freedom and freedom of choice, and that I'm not sure it could have developed in any other country, although it is spreading around to many, many countries. And that's one of the things that I want to talk about today with Bob. But before we get to that, what about your latest book? Let me bring that up for you.
Well, I, of course, thank you for that. It's called Reality Therapy and Self-Evaluation, The Key to Client Change. And it took me 3 years to write this book. It always takes me a long time to write a book. In fact, one of them took me 7 years. It was called The Reality Therapy for the 21st Century. And that's written about 10 or 12 years ago. But this is the idea is in this book, there's a lot of dialogues with people, hypothetical dialogues, and about their current situation, the grief, feelings of being oppressed, et cetera, and being rejected. And how do you help them take a look at their lives and evaluate it? And it's kind of based on the principle that as human beings, we have this undying belief in things that don't work. If it isn't working, do more of it. And as we look around, we can certainly see that in families and our culture seems to subscribe to that in many instances. If something's not working, do it louder and do it more, whereas it's very helpful, and we don't shove this down people's throats or be harsh about it, but is what you're doing, take a look at what you're doing in your relationship, criticizing, blaming, et cetera. Is that getting you where you want to go? Is it bringing you closer to the people around you? Is it helping you to feel better? And so this book focuses on that. There's an explanation of the overall theory and practice in the beginning, but there's dozens of dialogues in that book, and it's designed to help anybody, really, who wants to improve their lives, take a look at what they're doing and ask, what can I do that's different, that's better? So, but I like your concept that this is an American system in its origins, but the interesting thing is that people from around the world have taken an interest in it, and when we have our international conference, which was in Korea in 2016, we had people from every continent except Antarctica. And we're working on that. I always say I want to go to Antarctica, but only in the summertime when it's warm. But it's not a very good joke. But at any rate, the idea is
it's a passable joke. It's a passable.
It's passable. It's a C grade. But
there are people from all over the world who subscribe to these. I'm not saying millions of people in all the countries, but they think it's applicable to them. And now, of course, it needs to be adapted and adjusted. But it's an open system.
You know, America was hoped it would be a shining city on a hill by the founders. You know, their whole idea was this was not just for themselves, but future generations in America and the whole world, because they believed in liberty and in choice and freedom and all these things that are a package about human beings living their own lives to the best of their ability. And of course, people around the world love that idea and want to flock to America.
Yes, they do. Yeah, there's a long line of people trying to get into this country and live here, and a short line trying to get out. So that ought to be worth something for us.
Yeah, and they're mostly sneaking out to avoid the law. There's not too many people that really want to leave America.
That's right.
There's a lot of people who keep threatening to do so politically, but they never go.
They never do. They never do.
So talk some about how different cultures adapt to these very American ideas and how you may have to handle use your own communication skills to help them understand it.
Yes, I can do that because I've traveled around the world teaching this. Last year, my wife and I were in Korea and Singapore, and the year before that, we were in Korea and Japan, those two countries, and I've introduced it to those countries, in fact, and introduced it into the United Kingdom and into the Middle East, in Kuwait, for example. So other people have traveled around the world teaching it too. I'm not the only one, but it seems to be applicable. But I always encourage people to use. As I told one of my friends who writes textbooks, and he was very nervous about going to Korea one time, and he keep calling me saying, "Is this okay to do this? Is that okay to do this? Is this okay to do it?" And I said, finally, I said, you know, just use your ears and your mouth in the proportion in which God gave them to you, 2-1, and you'll be okay. Now, that's pretty simple, but there's a little bit more to it than that. But I think that's a good place to start and to listen very carefully. But people have different ways of expressing themselves, and some people, like in Asia, are. And I know this is a stereotype, but it seems to be true. Not in every case, but they tend to speak in a little bit more indirect way. For example, my friend Masaki Kakatani, who translates for me in Japan and who has himself taught it extensively there, he says that asking people, what do you want, as we do in reality therapy and many theories, I suppose, he said that can be kind of intrusive. And he says he translates that, what are you looking for? What are you striving for? Which to my Western ear sounds pretty much the same, but it's apparently quite different to the Asian ear, or to at least to in Japan. And so we have to kind of say things a little differently. And then we help people evaluate their own behavior, but in a culture where family is strong, it isn't just what's helping you. It's what do your parents think about this? What does your even grandparents think about this? Is it what would they say about your choices and your behavior? So it's kind of like involving the community, and that's a very good lesson for us too. I think we can learn from that cultural system and adapt it to our own helping, our own therapy and counseling. And so those are a couple of ideas. And when I taught in Kuwait, they asked me many years ago, about 20 years ago, they asked me if I was a Muslim. Why? They said, because everything you're teaching is compatible with the teachings of the Prophet. And so I was kind of surprised about that. But But I thought it's a good idea to know a little bit about that religion if you're going to teach in the Middle East, because their religion is very much part of their culture and of their daily practice as therapists. So,
I think you can integrate. How much go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
When you're doing therapy, how much do you actually just talk flat out about choices and ask, well, what was that choice? Did you know you were making a choice? Do you get into an actual discussion about choices?
I think so, Peter, but the timing has to be right. I think we can get caught up in jargon, and that kind of turns people off. But, I think, yes, there is a time when we directly ask people, what choices do you have? And what do you want to choose to do today? But you can overdo any kind of language, I think. And I tend to stay away from, telling people they're choosing things. I just kind of act as if they are choosing things by asking them, what are you going to do today? What choices do you have in this matter? What are some decisions you're going to face that you could evaluate and then choose them? Choose a course of action. So, as I say, talking to the healthy part of the person. I have a little axiom, and that is sometimes the solution appears to have nothing to do with the problem. And when we get people involved with fun activities and we get them involved in relationships, oftentimes their depression is lessened. I'm not saying it vanishes completely, but it's lessened, and they can have a much more productive life. Look at 12-step programs. 12-step programs, what do they do in 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous? They go and they satisfy their need for belonging and for gaining control in their lives. Now, at first, that may seem to have nothing to do with drinking all day. Well, it has everything to do with it. And when we help people connect with each other better, their depression seems to be less, and their antisocial behavior seems to be less, as well as their destructive use of drugs.
Yes, often what people say is very indirect. You know, a client may say that. Well, I think my classic example for me was many, many years ago, when a client called me up after a session in the evening and said, Peter, I know you don't believe in medicine, but could I get a Valium so that I could have a good night's sleep? And I said, well, why didn't you bring it up today in the session? And she said, well, you weren't listening very well today. So I said, well, how would you feel if I just gave you a free session tomorrow? She said, that'd be fine. Thank you much. I'm sure I'll have a good, better night's sleep. So ask a few things.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You must have had a good relationship with her for her to tell you that.
But, I had to ask her. I mean, yeah. I had to actually address what she was saying so that she felt like maybe I'm giving her a window open. If we'd had a better relationship, she might have said after 10 minutes, said, Pete, where are you today?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I don't think it's so much a good relationship as I had the good sense to ask her a few questions and give her the opportunity to at least afterward tell me that I didn't seem to be listening very well that day. And it's also, of course, a story about drugs. I mean, why do people want medications? And it's so often because they don't have any hope of getting anything better from the people they're seeing.
Yeah.
Because everybody really values being talked with and being heard. At least I think everybody does. Some people aren't ready for it. Some people rebel and and, you know, and just aren't ready to look at themselves. And that's fine. People got to live their lives. But by and large, most people really are awfully happy to have somebody listen to them and provide some thoughts and guidance, some direction.
Yeah, I think that's true. And people, you know, I think this idea of drugs, I don't say much about medications to people because I'm not a psychiatrist or not an MD person, and I don't want to get in trouble by being accused of giving medical advice. But it seems to me it's part of a more general desire that our culture kind of tells us is possible, and that is that something out there is going to solve our problems. It may be a drug, it may be when the weather changes, it may be when I graduate from high school, that's going to solve my problem, and when I go to college or when I graduate, when I get married and when I retire, you know, something out there is going to change my life. Well, it might help, of course, but at the same time, until that happens, let's try to work on a few things. I mean, if I talk to I've talked to a 15-year-old who's got 3 months till he's 16, and he says, I'm going to drop out at when I'm turned to 16, I'm going to drop out of school. I say, well, let's talk about those 3 months. How do you want those 3 months to be? Rather than responding to the most obvious cue that he gives me, which is dropping out. I think many kids want us to kind of argue with them about that. I would say don't argue. Just talk about, let's talk about your choices now until that happens. And because that's what you have control over. You don't have control over what's going to happen in 3 months or 3 years or 20 years. So it's a matter of where do you want to focus? And I'd suggest focusing on how to empower them now, today.
Well, and that youngster's likely, I think that's a very good approach. That youngster is likely to, in that process, maybe grasp why they should stay in school.
Yeah.
And they look at what do they want to do.
Sure.
Because, of course, without high school, there's not a lot one can do unless you have spectacular qualities of some kind that people really want to pay for. It's pretty hard to go out there without even a high school diploma.
That's right.
But I think it's very good. You know, I try to avoid arguing. Arguing in general is fighting.
Yeah.
And it has winners and losers. And the loser never admits they lost. They just get mad. And I try to really encourage people to avoid arguing with people. It's really kind of a fruitless thing. You either want to reach an understanding with folks, or you probably shouldn't be talking to them because it will come to no particular good end.
Yeah, I think
reaching an understanding.
I'll ask parents, have you ever won an argument with a 15-year-old? And they say no. And I say, well, what happens when you argue? And they say they just get more resistant. And that's just not 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
That's many people. They just get more resistant. And what's the point of arguing? The idea is to enlist them as allies instead of as people you want to overpower with logic. Not too many people are overpowered by logic, but they're engaged with a relationship, an understanding, compassionate relationship.
How much did Bill Glasser talk about compassion and empathy, love? I know he certainly liked those kinds of ideas, but did he make it a part of reality therapy, a choice theory?
I don't think he ever or rarely mentioned empathy, but I think he had much compassion. He probably wouldn't use those words. I never heard him use those words, but I'll tell you, he helped people. When I've seen so many of his demonstrations, and when he was a psychiatrist, he used to make house calls occasionally. Can you imagine that? That's real compassion to me. Is doing that sort of thing. And but I don't think he said a lot about it. But now love, that was.
absolutely very thematic in his teaching, because in the choice theory, which is the theory underlying reality therapy, he talked about five needs, one of them being love and belonging, one of them being power or inner control, and one being freedom, and one being fun, and then, of course, the physiological needs. But belonging was so crucial. As a matter of fact, he went to the extent of saying most long-term psychological problems are, in fact, relationship problems. Now, some people will argue with that, but he was very cautious about how he said that. Most long-term, emotional problems. Now, I always say at least that's a good place to start. Who's important in your life, and how can you move closer to them? I mean, I got that idea from him. He's the one that I heard talk about it. So, yeah, belonging and love, giving love and receiving love were cornerstones in reality therapy.
And he actually stopped giving drugs, psychiatric drugs, before I had a chance to even think about it. Finished his training and he said, I'm not giving psychiatric drugs?
Yeah, really quite a rebel, I guess, or I wouldn't say rebel. I guess the word is, he just was an unusual psychiatrist. Yeah, he used to say that he never, ever gave any kind of psychiatric drugs. And, that's really saying something. So that's why he picked up on your work so readily.
Yeah. And he also liked when I talked about love and caring. So
sure.
I always felt like we were on a very similar theme together. How do you feel the movement is doing right now to get the word out? Is there increased interest in Glasser's work?
I think there. Skyrocketing, I'll put it that way. But we do have an international organization, but these are volunteers on this international board. So it's tough going because of a lot of reasons, and I think it is holding steady, but I can't say it's spiking in its interest. And it's kind of up to people like me and other people who teach this to continue the, as I say, keep the flag flying. And but it's a tough journey. But I think the interest is in the young therapists and counselors. I see a lot of interest there because they love the ideas when you teach it to them. And it's in most of the textbooks. I've written 36 chapters in textbooks. So it's widely taught in universities, to that extent, I think it is becoming mainstream. I just wish there were more people taking the training. So,
do you think Bill was a little harder edged when he was young? I remember reading his very earliest stuff, and it sounded. And I'm not sure I'm right in my memory or my thoughts, but it sounded very confrontational. And I think a lot of it was done in prisons, wasn't it, where the people were voluntary?
Yes, it started in a mental hospital and a correctional institution. And so where you meet some very difficult people and very disturbed people and people who have made some, choices and that have been harmful to them. And so he was kind of confrontational in his demonstrations, too, when he taught it. But I always say that was his style. It wasn't necessarily essential to the practice of reality therapy, and he would certainly agree with that. I always say take what is useful and leave aside what's not useful if you learn any system. And but he could be kind of, I don't know if the word's confrontational or direct, I suppose is a better word, but the way he practiced it is not the way I would practice it. Not that I would do radically different, but some of it is personality. And I always say, you know, people gave reality therapy that image that they say reality therapy is harsh. And my response is, systems are not harsh or permissive. People are. And so you can practice client-centered following Carl Rogers and be overly permissive. He wasn't, but that could be somebody's perception of it. And the same way with reality therapy, I don't think the system is harsh. I think that we can use it in a kind of confrontational manner. And when we do that, I think what I know my experience has been that I'm not listening to the person. I'm more interested in what I'm going to say. And that kind of puts a barrier between us and really hinders the therapeutic alliance that we aim at. So, yeah, I think, I just make those
decisions. Do you yourself talk much about people's childhoods, about their how their choice making was influenced by their childhood viewpoints? I think is very important in the work I do of trying to help people see that their experiences gave them limited choices, and they made choices for survival or choices to maintain their flagging self-esteem or worth, and those choices aren't real good ones for today. They might have kept them alive back then, like shutting up and not confronting your abuser when you're 3 years old. Do you talk about that kind of thing?
That's a very good point, Peter, because it brings up a whole range of ideas. And I suggest to people, and I do this myself, if they want to talk about it, yes. But if they don't want to talk about it, I'd say, okay, if you ever want to talk about it, we can talk about it. It might be useful. But and just saying that helps them to relax, and they'll become less reluctant to bring up pain that they have suffered over the years. So if someone has been abused and they've talked about it 100 times, I ask them, well, I'll be glad to listen, but is one more time going to make any difference? And if you've never talked about it, maybe it's a good idea to talk about it. Now, there is a principle in reality therapy to stress current behaviors. So sometimes you hear instructors say, that's past, we're not going to talk about it. I think that's, I think that's a mistake, to put it mildly, because to me it is not past behavior. The action might be past, but the thinking and the emotions and even the physiology can be very, very present. William Faulkner, the great American novelist, said, the past is never dead. In fact, it is not even past. In other words, we live with our current feelings and our current thinking, as is so common in the treatment of trauma. These are current thoughts and current actions, and current feelings. So to me, yes, I think we do need to allow people to talk about it, because it's current. It isn't past. The event might be past. You take a veteran who saw some pretty horrible things in Afghanistan or Iraq or even longer ago than that. The consequences are very current. So to just slough that off and think that it's past, I just don't think that's very effective. But yes,
I talked to a very interesting group called, I think it was called the International Association of Biblical Therapists, very conservative folks.
Yeah.
And what they would do is they would try to find passages in the Bible that were applicable to the troubles, the suffering, whatever the difficulties were of the individual. And encourage them to open their hearts to Jesus and to God. And I was doing a plenary, and I kind of snuck in that, and I talked about drugs. It was one of the reasons they wanted me there, was they didn't think drugs were the answer.
Yeah.
As many conservative people in groups don't think that taking drugs is the answer. Some do.
Yeah.
And I said, but you know, it might help you at times to ask the person you're trying to help open their hearts to love for God or Jesus or their families, what happened to them in childhood that makes it hard for them to open their hearts. And I just passed that by a little bit. And afterward, two or three of the therapists came up to me and in hushed voices said, I do that a little bit. So we can break with systems, and people do. And I'm sorry to hear that the International Licensure of Coaches Group, whatever it's called, I've heard of them. We've talked about them a little bit on the show, that they don't want coaches looking at the past. And I think that if coaches get training in that, they could coach about overcoming your past. So
yeah.
I want things to be wider open about helping, because the more restrictions you put on who can say what, the more we're, first of all, people aren't free to talk. They're not free to exercise their freedom of speech. But also, the more costly the approach, because that kind of divvying up who can do what is always trade unionism. It's always the guild that's being defended. And because I'm even in favor, Bob, I don't know if you knew this. I can't remember what we may have talked about together or in my talks, but I'm in favor of psychologists talking about psychiatric drugs and what they know about them and giving them sources and suggesting if they think that that maybe they need to reevaluate their medications. I don't see anything wrong with that, even if it's a cancer treatment that they're coming to you with. I think people should be free based on their experience, acknowledging what it is and isn't. A coach who's been talking about people's lives and their childhoods for 10 years or 20 years is feels confident and comfortable with it is certainly going to be better than the good old psychoanalysts were, who didn't talk hardly at all. So I think I want to see things really open up in regard to who can talk about what in helping people. And the secret may be that coaching now is too limited because it's becoming a guild. And if that happens, then I think we'll need new names and things. Your thoughts about that?
I think it'd be a good idea, but I feel constricted by the kind of the standard practice and the ethics that I have as a psychologist and as a counselor, is to be very careful about what we say about, for instance, medications. I always say, well, I suggest you discuss that with your physician. Now, I know that presents problems too, but at the same time, I don't want to get involved with being accused of giving medical advice, even though I might feel like it at times. But there are these guidelines. They're more than guidelines. They're really ethical principles, and that to me, it's just a little bit. It's not actually contradicting what you said, but it's sort of restricting. But I like how you said you might evaluate your use of the medication that's been given to you. I think that's perfectly fine. I think that's part of our responsibility.
It's perfectly fine for you to suggest somebody Google or go to Mad in America
or
read somebody's books. We're still a free society, and I had a therapist refer somebody to me with the words that I think you're over-medicated by your psychiatrist, and it saved her life.
Yeah.
She was in the midst of a serotonin syndrome, a life-threatening reaction to antidepressants, and her psychiatrist didn't even notice it.
Yeah.
And she didn't know what the fevers and the chills were coming from, and the achy muscles and the hyperactive reflexes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, and then there's a trend, too, that the psychologists want parity, they call it. They want to be able to prescribe drugs. And so that will probably happen in the future. It's just my opinion, but there certainly is a movement in that direction. And
well, some of them are getting that right in some states.
Some states
they take certification programs, yeah, and they can do it. And in the armed services, some can do it.
Yes, yeah. There's a couple of states already that have endorsed that, but I know I'm not going to take the training to do that because I don't want to be tempted to do it, to prescribe. So, but yeah, I've referred people to your books, for example. And
I think that's a fine thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. But let me just say one thing about.
A lot of good books out there now, too. I mean, it's not like the past where you couldn't refer them to anybody but my books. There's a lot of good books out there.
I just want to say one thing, if we have a moment here, about the distinction between choice theory and reality therapy. Choice theory, according to Glasser, is the basis of reality therapy. In fact, he and Carlene wrote an article about this for the international newsletter a couple of years ago. And he said choice theory is the train track and reality therapy is the train. In other words, the train track gives you direction. It points the way. And yet you need a vehicle for delivering the product. You need both. And so I hear people say they're doing choice theory. Well, to me, that's like doing gravity. You don't do gravity. You drop a ball on the floor and it falls. That's the action. And the law of gravity explains it. So choice theory explains reality therapy. And I base that on the statement of both William and Carlene Glasser some years ago. And there's a textbook written by Dick Scharf. And he sent me an email and he said, I like the idea that you have a different name for the theory and than the practice. He said, that helps me explain it in my textbook. And I thought that was very telling because he said it's just about the only system that has a different name for the theory. So I thought, boy, that really says it all. And because he, you know, writes he's one of the many textbook writers on counseling and psychotherapy. So it's
we're going to be finished pretty quick. We're talking with Robert E. Wubbolding, Wubbolding. Bob, in a word or two, we got just literally a minute. Where can people learn the most about you and about reality therapy?
Oh, okay. Well, I'd say this book published by the American Counseling Association, and it's under the Wiley, W-I-L-E-Y, publisher also. That would be one place. And then check my website, which is realitytherapywub.com.
Thanks a ton for being on the show, Bob. I love having good therapists on the show with good ideas. Folks, being a therapist is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Look into it if you're not doing it. Figure out if you would like to do it. We need good folks out there who want to learn to help people and to do it drug-free and in the right way. And thanks for being a great audience. And check out my new feature, my frequent alerts on Bregan.com, and keep up with my series on Michelle Carter. Bye-bye, folks. Bye-bye, Bob.
Bye. Thanks again, Dr. Bregan.
Oh, thank you.